So, we're getting going on one of the greatest calculations in physics, which is showing that this model of the early universe gives the Gaussian nearly scale invariant adiabatic conditions that are needed to explain all of our data. The model is just the usual Einstein-Hilbert gravity term plus a minimally coupled scalar field, that means this kinetic term, minus a slow roll potential. Last time we worked out the equations of motion of the field. So without making any approximations, I didn't assume that I was in a field configuration, which is a small perturbation of an FRW solution or anything. Just generally speaking, from this action, the equation of motion for phi and the stress energy tensor are given by these expressions. This is sort of the first thing you compute when you like stare at an action. Then we started analyzing the background. We'll put in the fluctuations next. But let's talk a little bit about the background, which is just the case where the scalar field phi is a function of t. And the only degrees, and the metric is the FRW, unperturbed FRW metric. All right, so in this special case, we had shown that the stress energy tensor, we worked out the covariant derivatives and so on and showed that it had the FRW form, as it has to by symmetry. The FRW form here, where the FRW energy density is this, and the FRW pressure is this. So the kinetic energy phi dot squared is acting as a component with equation of state plus one, and the potential energy is acting as a component with equation of state W equals minus one, like a cosmological constant. All right, and so the next thing we're going to work out is the equation of motion of the inflaton. We'll specialize this formula to this setup, this unperturbed setup. So we just need to expand specialize this to this metric. And so a useful general formula this is all unperturbed that an unperturbed FRW the divergence of a vector field so if I'm taking covariant divergence of some vector field, well, one way to compute it is to write it out in Christoffel symbols. You can look up, this is in the formula sheet that I've been updating on the wiki. This looks like T, this is a Christoffel symbol gamma. If I look at the Christoffel symbols in unperturbed FRW, this guy is 3H and this guy is with a spatial index is 0, as it has to be by symmetry. The covariant divergence of a vector field has this. It's the ordinary divergence plus this extra term, 3h times the time part. Roughly speaking, what that means is that divergence-free vector fields want a redshift down like a to the minus 3. For example, the number density of a bunch of the physical number density of a bunch of particles at rest redshifts as a to the minus 3, and it's the zero component of the number current vector. Another way to derive this, just for fun, would be to use the general formula that this is 1 over square root minus g partial mu square root minus g x mu, and put in the a to the minus 3 for the minus g. Okay, so specialized to the case where the vector field is the gradient of this scalar that gives partial mu. The only guy that's non-zero is the zero component, which is minus del phi del t. That gives this formula for the covariant Laplacian. So the equation of motion is, and the without perturbations is just phi double dot plus 3h phi dot plus v prime of phi equals 0. And this h is called the Hubble friction term. Without it, we just have the equation of motion for a point, you know, falling down the potential well. This term means that the point is so, that the value of the scalar field is sort of pinned in its potential by the expansion of the universe. So this equation plus Friedman's equation, which gives the evolution of the scale factor A. When I'm thinking about the early universe, I write, like to write 8 pi g as 1 over m Planck squared. These two equations are all that you need to determine the evolution of the background. Now, there's an approximation to these equations that comes up. Now, these equations aren't particularly complicated. I mean, for any potential, they'd be easy to throw on the computer and integrate. There's an approximation that often comes up, which makes them even simpler. And the real reason for this approximation is it turns out to be what's necessary if the fluctuations produced by inflation are going to agree with the observations, if they're going to be approximately scale invariant, small and approximately scale invariant. We haven't shown that yet. So the way that I'll motivate the slow roll approximation, I haven't really shown why you would restrict attention to this case. But I can say what it is. It's it's simply the approximation that, well, it's two things. In the equation of motion for the inflaton, that the first term is small compared to the others. And in the Friedman equation, that the potential term dominates the kinetic term. This is what you might expect to happen if things are sort of evolving slowly, if the situation is a small perturbation of de Sitter. Then the terms with the most time derivatives would tend to be small compared to the other terms. So slow roll is nice. Because you can convert any quantity to like local derivatives of phi. So for example, this one's trivial because you just read it off. The value of the Hubble parameter in slow roll is just m Planck to the minus 1 times v over 3 to the 1/3. Just read off from here. If I want to know phi dot in the slow roll approximation, no problem. This first equation says that it's minus v prime over 3h. And then putting in the first formula, that's minus m Planck v prime over v to the 1/2. I'll use this next one in a sec. If I wanted the second derivative, well, I just take one more derivative here. Just differentiate this expression, my expression for phi dot with respect to phi. Then add a phi dot. And then plugging in, taking the derivative and plugging in the phi dot that I had here. Let me put a slow roll suffix. I get m Planck squared times and so on. Any quantity involving derivatives or phi of h, you can just work out in terms of some expansion and local derivatives of the potential. Okay, now let's work out the conditions on the potential phi that need to be satisfied for the slow roll approximation to work. So let me ask the question, for which potential is V? Is the slow roll approximation valid? And in order to work this out, you could just reason as follows. For any potential, I could just go ahead and integrate the slow roll equations of motion. So those are like one derivative down from the real equations of motion, from the unapproximated equations of motion. Go ahead and integrate the slow roll approximated equations of motion. And then once I have the whole trajectory, then at every point along the trajectory, I just evaluate the terms that I neglected and show that they're a small correction to the terms that I kept. So the slow roll approximation will be valid if, I need two things to be true. I need phi double dot to be less than 3h phi dot. And I need 1/2 phi dot squared to be less than b. Where I've put the SRs to emphasize that it's OK to evaluate these quantities on the slow roll solution, i.e. in the slow roll approximation. So if you plug in these formulas for phi double dot and phi dot, then here are the conditions that you get. The first equation says that you just convert everything to derivatives of V to get a condition on the potential. The first equation says this condition must be true. And the second equation says that m Planck squared. And so an equivalent way of writing these is to introduce the slow roll parameters. Introduce. Epsilon, these are definitions. Defined to be v prime over v squared in Planck units with a factor of 2, that's a convention. And eta is v double prime over v in Planck units. Then the conditions are that the first condition says that epsilon minus eta over 3 is much less than 1. And the second condition says that epsilon over 3 is much less than 1. which of course is the same thing as saying that both sole parameters are small. So these conditions are the technical definition of a flat potential. So what we mean by a flat potential. And a lot of simple potentials are flat, like m squared phi squared, for example, or any small power here. Will qualify as a flat potential that you can inflate on. There is an assumption here, by the way. In this case, both sole parameters for a potential like this, both sole parameters are parametrically phi to the minus 2 times m Planck squared. So it's a potential like this, a monomial potential, is only slow roll for field values which are larger than m Planck. That is the regime that's considered when we talk about inflation on this type of potential, the so-called large field regime. Okay, almost done talking about the background solution. Let's see. Let me just write a couple more things down. So the equation of, let's see. So rho also means that, I think this comment is helpful, that inappropriate units nothing changes much in a Hubble time. For example, phi dot over h, which is like the change in phi for Hubble. Is 2 epsilon to the 1/2 m Planck. I'm just plugging in formulas up there. A field value doesn't change much in a Hubble time, provided you interpret it in m Planck units. Those are sort of the natural units there. And h dot over h. It's easy to work out in the slow roll approximation that this is all the leading order in slow roll, in epsilon and eta. That it's minus epsilon h. So this means that in a Hubble time, h doesn't change much relative to the value of h, i.e. the fractional change is small. That's something that I kind of been implicitly assuming when I was talking about slow roll, that h was roughly constant. The second equation is equivalent to the statement that w is close to minus 1. In fact, in slow roll, this is the value of w. So the scale factor, we're in a roughly Disutter situation where the scale factor is roughly e to the ht. All right. So that's all I have to say about the background solution. So the next step is going to be to expand in fluctuations around the background solution and work out the quantum mechanical production of perturbations. So that's what I'm going to do next. This is a very famous and central calculation in cosmology. But before I do that, I want to just sort of talk a little bit in general about how quantum mechanics produces perturbations and produces fluctuations in an expanding universe. And this is going to be mostly review from the first class, I think. I guess not everyone took the first class. Let me start. I'm going to spend a little bit of time reviewing or talking about it because, let me just start with a confession, which is that when I first saw this material, I personally did not understand it. The way it's sometimes presented is so streamlined that it's hard to really see in a concrete way what the underlying physics is. So I'm going to go back. There's a very simple sort of formula for calculating the quantum mechanical perturbations, which is roughly that you just compute the classical equation of motion and then normalize it with a prescription that comes from quantum mechanics to track the variance of the quantum mechanically produced fluctuations as a function of time. But why that's the right prescription, I think it's useful to explain in a very back-to-basics way. So I'm going to start with just an ordinary time-dependent harmonic oscillator in ordinary quantum mechanics, just 1 degree of freedom. Simple harmonic oscillator in ordinary quantum mechanics. So I'm just talking about the Schrodinger equation with this time-dependent Hamiltonian. I want to suppose that at early times, the frequency goes to some constant value omega naught, and the system is in its ground state there. In other words, if we define ladder operators and A applied to psi at some time, initial time t0. And we want to find the behavior of the wave function for all times when omega starts to vary. Now, a few general comments. So it's a general theorem in quantum mechanics that if the system starts out in its ground state and the change in the Hamiltonian is adiabatic, then the system will stay in the ground state. The ground state changes with time. The system, the wave function, stays in that ground state. And adiabatic means that the change in the Hamiltonian is small compared to the natural time scale of the system. So what that would mean here is that d omega dt is much less than omega squared. Just by dimensional analysis, this is the only possibility. Another regime is the regime where we change the value of omega slowly. Then it's easy to see what happens, which is that since the Hamiltonian jumped discontinuously, the definition of the ground state jumped, but the wave function can't jump; it has to be unchanged. So then psi can't change discontinuously, and that's just because the wave function can never change discontinuously in quantum mechanics. You know, the Schrodinger equation says this. So if h changes discontinuously, then the derivative of the wave function changes discontinuously, the time derivative. So the wave function's evolution as a function of time has a kink in it, but not a jump. So it's easy to see, for example, that we can get excited states out of this. All we have to do is just start the system in the ground state and then just change suddenly to a different value of omega. Now, there's a really powerful trick for computing, for solving the system exactly, which is to work in the Heisenberg picture. Now, since the Heisenberg picture is usually defined in quantum mechanics textbooks for the case of a time-independent Hamiltonian, you know, the definition that you may have seen of the Heisenberg picture is that the way I Heisenbergize an operator, which is allowed to have explicit time dependence, is that I put an e to the minus ht here and an e to the iht here. That's the time-independent case. And of course, all you have to do to make the Heisenberg picture work in the time-dependent case is to replace these e to the minus hts by the unitary evolution operators. So this u is just the unitary evolution operator that goes evolves from time t0 to time t by integrating the Schrodinger equation. So that's what I mean by Heisenbergizing an operator. And then it's with this as a definite, taking this as a definition, it's easy to show that the Heisenberg equation of motion is that the time derivative of OH is, since this is allowed to have explicit time dependence, then I'll put the derivative, partial derivative of that explicit time dependence here, and then the new term is this. Where what appears in the commutator on the right-hand side is the Hamiltonian in the Heisenberg picture. In the time-independent case, you don't have to say whether the H is the Hamiltonian in the Schrodinger picture or the Heisenberg picture, because, of course, it commutes with the unitary evolution operators. But the time-dependent case, that's not necessarily true. Okay. So this is all constructed. I should have said that the point of the definition is that in the Schrodinger picture, you evolve the wave function to some time t. And then if I want the expectation value of an operator, I compute this expectation value. In the Heisenberg picture, you just start with some initial wave function. You don't evolve it. And you evaluate the Heisenberg picture operator. So the Heisenberg picture operator is just whatever operator you need to apply to the initial state to evaluate expectation functions at a later time. It contains the unitary evolution to that later time, the operator of interest, and then unitary evolution back because that you have to apply to the bra. Okay. You guys probably know all that already, but I wanted to say it anyway. Okay, so in this simple harmonic oscillator case, the Heisenberg equations of motion for X and P are the same as the classical equations of motion. There's no like issues like non-commutivity, non-commutativity, or getting new operators. So I'm just evaluating these commutators using the canonical commutation relation that says that the commutator of an X and a P is I. What's really powerful here is that the reason why this works is that if I take the derivatives of X and P, then I get sort of a closed system of operator equations. For a more complicated system, you know, you get new operators appear. What usually happens is that you get new operators appear here on the right-hand side. You have to consider their derivatives, and the system may not close. But here, you have just some really simple, you know, linear system of differential equations, but with operators instead of ordinary numbers. Okay, so at early times, when omega is omega naught, then these are just simple harmonic motion, and the solution is the solution of those equations of motion is this. Here I'm going to put the Schrodinger suffixes explicitly to indicate that I haven't Heisenbergized the operators. Oops, no T here. Shorting our minus omega naught. Okay. So in a basis of ladder operators, I can equivalently write this as so I have negative frequencies on the lowering operator and positive frequencies on the raising operator. Okay. Now it's not hard to see that for time-dependent omega, the solution to the Heisenberg equations of motion is just obtained by replacing these exponentials by the solution to the classical equations of motion. So U of T dot. And why is that? Well, here's one way to see it. It's sort of clear from the Heisenberg equations of motion that if I start out at initial times with a solution, which is a linear combination of A and A dagger for all times, then if I evolve with these equations, I'm going to stay in that space. I'm always going to have a solution which is just a linear combination of A and A daggers, because the derivatives are just generating a new linear combination of A and A dagger out of an old one. So the solution sort of has to take this general form with some functions in front of the coefficients that I don't know yet. And then you can work out that this guy, I'll just say this in words, I won't write this whole thing down, that this guy has to be the complex conjugate of this guy because x is always Hermitian. And then this guy has to be the derivative of this guy in order for this Heisenberg equation of motion to be satisfied. And then you can check that the second Heisenberg equation of motion is satisfied if U satisfies the classical equation of motion. One thing that I've really learned from thinking through the quantum mechanics is what the normalization of this mode function should be at early times. It should look like this prefactor at early times. Okay. So the statement that the Heisenberg picture operators are linear combinations of just ordinary Schrodinger picture operators, these are the guys that the right hand side is what you apply to the initial state, is very powerful. For example, if we want to calculate the spread of the wave function at a later time, at time t, then we just say, well, that would be the same thing as taking the initial wave function, which is just the ordinary vacuum state, and applying the square of the Heisenberg picture operator. taking that expectation value. Maybe I should write T0 instead of 0. And then that, if I write it out, so this is U of T A plus U star of T A dagger times another copy of the same thing. Now, when I expand this out, only the term with a dagger gives something non-zero here, because the lowering operator annihilates the initial state by assumption. And likewise here, when I apply the lowering operator to the initial bra, I have to get 0. So only the u, sorry, I said that backwards. When I apply the raising operator to the initial bra, I have to get 0. So only the u survives. And I just get u of t star. So the mode function U describes the spread of the wave function as a function of time. And of course, you could generalize this to compute the expectation value of pretty much any operator. Now, another thing that this simple solution to the Heisenberg equations of motion implies is that the wave function psi of t, I didn't actually compute the Schrodinger picture wave function. But if I had computed it, then I would find that it is a Gaussian function of x. At all times. The only thing that's changing is the width of the Gaussian. And there's also sort of a phase parameter in there, too. So let's prove this. So this fact about the Heisenberg picture solution contains a prescription for the wave function. You just kind of have to invert the Schrodinger picture. So the first thing that I want to do is say that if I have this expression for just for fun, I'll take this argument far enough to actually write down the wave function. So if I have this equation, then I'll just invert the matrix . You'll see why I'm doing this in a sec, to express the raising and lowering operators as linear combinations of the Heisenberg picture operators. Now, a little loophole here that I actually want to think about is the question of why this matrix is invertible. So there are actually two different possible answers to this question. So let me throw it out as like a real-time quiz. Can anyone think of an argument for why this matrix always has to be invertible?
That means related to the time derivative of the expectation value, right? Of x squared?
Not exactly. That's actually a good way of thinking about it. It's not quite. It's not quite the same thing, because you won't get the minus signs. And you're thinking of the determinant, right? That's sort of a high-tech way of putting it. And maybe a low-tech way of saying the same thing is that the determinant of this is the expectation value of, your answer is also obviously on the right track, is the expectation value of the commutator x hat p hat. If you expand out this expectation value the same way that I expanded out x squared, you will get the minus sign in the determinant. And since that's a canonical commutator, its expectation value is just equal to I. Okay, so it's invertible, and this argument even gave me a formula for the inverse, because I can just divide by the determinant and rearrange here according to Cramer's rule. See, I get u dot star here, u star here. Dot star. Some minus signs. Okay. So what is the point of expressing the initial Schrodinger picture operators in terms of the Heisenberg picture operators at a later time? Well, since I know that, it lets me solve for the wave function. I know that the initial lowering operator annihilated the vacuum state. And if you think about it, that now implies that if I take this linear combination, if I write, well, so let me do it in two steps. If I write AS as a linear combination of Heisenberg picture operators, let's write that as minus I u dot star x hat minus u dot p hat, that annihilates the initial state. That now implies that the same linear combination of operators without the H's annihilates the wave function at the time t. That's just because I'm just sort of doing the Heisenberg picture thing backwards. I could expand this out as I could convert the H's to S's with a U here and a U dagger here. The U here, it just gives me the wave function at the later time t. And the only way that can be zero is if the wave function at time t is annihilated by this linear combination of Schrodinger operators. This is kind of a general method if you've solved a system in the Heisenberg picture for actually finding the wave function. Of course, the Heisenberg picture solution is a full solution, so the wave function is encoded in there somewhere. But then this is a differential equation that I can write down if I just think of this as an ordinary differential equation applied to the differential operator applied to the wave function at time t. This is going to be minus u dot over I times partial derivative with respect to x. Let's write as plus I. Oh, I lost the star. Dot star x. And now I have a differential equation that I can just solve to find the Schrodinger picture wave function. Let me do one more thing to this and write it as this way. I'll say that the x derivative of the wave function has to be plus I times u dot star over u dot. Oh no! I deviated too far from my notes, and I made an error here that crept into some of these formulas. So let me go back and correct. This should have been minus u star with no time derivative, with the minus u dot down here, the same error kind of crept in here. This should have been minus u star. Star. Sorry about that. I got so excited about all these operators, I forgot to look at the notes. All right, so this is u star. The correct coefficient here is u star over u dot star. So it's that. Okay. So this argument has told me that the Schrodinger picture wave function satisfies this differential equation. If I differentiate it, that has to be the same thing as bringing down x times a constant. The differential equation is easy to solve, or you can kind of read off the solution. The wave function must, the only way that can be true is if the wave function looked like, looked like e to the constant times x squared, where the constant is I over 2 times u dot star over u star. So that implies that the wave function is Gaussian. So this is this is the one variable version. We'll jazz this up to talk about, you know, QFT and, you know, fields on an inflating space-time. But this is sort of the one variable reason why time-dependent Hamiltonians, at least in simple situations where there are no interactions, cubic terms, always generate Gaussian fields. You can think of a Gaussian wave function as being one which is annihilated by just some linear combination of x and p. And because the Heisenberg picture tells you that you're just always, the Heisenberg picture operators are always just rotating you around in the space spanned by x and p. You never leave that space. Then the condition that you're annihilated by one such operator in the initial conditions, namely the lowering operator A, tells you that you continue at all times to be annihilated by some linear combination of x and p. So the wave function is always Gaussian. But the coefficient here, you know, this number whose real part and phase, real and imaginary parts, give you the width of the Gaussian. And there's also, you know, an imaginary part here, so it wiggles, are generally can be kind of complicated. You have to solve the classical equations of motion, which can be complicated for a, if omega of t has a complicated form. Okay, so in summary, the generation of excited states, excited Gaussian states in ordinary quantum mechanics is actually very tame and non-mysterious. Now let's talk about a QFT case. Let's see. Let's do real quick the massless test scalar and de Sitter, and then do a more complicated example. Okay, so I want to think about test means that the metric is non-dynamical. So I'm talking about a So I'm talking about a scalar field with evolving fluctuations on a de Sitter background, but the scalar field doesn't source potential wells to perturb the de Sitter metric. So its action is the de Sitter metric, it's much easier to use conformal time for this calculation. So in conformal time, the de Sitter metric looks like this. Where the scale factor is minus 1 over h tau. H is constant. And tau goes from minus infinity to 0. De Sitter, as we said before, de Sitter space has finite conformal time in the future, but infinite physical time. So it doesn't actually, you don't actually fall off the edge of the universe. An observer can't actually get to tau equals 0 with a finite value on the clock. The action is this minus g. Let's write it as g upper mu nu.
Sorry, when you when you say there's a third space, do you mean that it's positive Kosmolov to the constant F or W?
Oh yeah, that's what I really mean. Yeah, I'm not thinking about global De Sitter. So I really mean the so-called static patch of De Sitter, which is just this piece. So putting in the form of the metric, when I raise the index, I get an a to the minus 2, and the square root minus g has an a to the fourth. So this looks like an overall prefactor of h tau squared times not tau phi squared. And as usual in QFT, I should have written this as d tau d3x. And as usual for a free QFT satisfying translation invariance, if I just write this in Fourier space, then the action will diagonalize in every, as a sum of an independent action for each Fourier mode. Now, I think it's clearest. So this is not exactly, so each Fourier mode evolves independently, but the action of the Fourier mode isn't exactly p squared minus, it should have been minus k squared phi k. So if there were no time dependence here, then this would just be a time-independent harmonic oscillator for each k. With the time dependence here, it's not quite what I considered before. What I considered before was the case where the time dependence was only on the x squared and not on the p squared. So I think it's clearest to, you could still do the calculation with the time dependence, put in this way. But the vacuum state that becomes a little less clear. So I'll explain how you avoid doing this, but I think it's pedagogically clearest. If I next canonically normalize, which just means changing variables to the variable for which the coefficient of phi dot squared is 1 or 1 half, rather. I'm just going to make the field redefinition phi equals h tau psi. And then I'll write the action. So in terms of this new canonically normalized field psi, the action looks like this. So if I put that in, when I take the derivative here, I'll get two terms that I expand out. So let's do that in one step. I get this piece, which is what I wanted, with no time dependence. This piece with one time derivative. So you get a 1 over tau. K star. Del psi K star. And then I get a term when I expand here with 0 derivatives, which I'll bring in here. To write it as minus k squared minus 1 over tau squared. Okay. In general, when you have terms in an action with one derivative, they're candidates for integration by parts to convert to terms of fewer derivatives. So if I recognize the expression in parentheses here as the time derivative of psi k star psi k, then I can integrate by parts and put the derivative on the 1 over tau and just absorb into this term.
Sorry, I'm a little bit fuzzy on which ones are t's and which ones are tau's.
They should all be tau's.
Okay.
Thanks. Thanks. Okay. So I'll just integrate by parts and put the derivative on the 1 over tau. There's a minus sign from the integration by parts, and then I get a minus 1 over tau squared. And that just changes this coefficient from a 1 to a 2. So I've now succeeded in canonically normalizing the field. So with this field redefinition, the action looks like the time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator that I had before. Each Fourier mode psi k behaves independently as one with this peculiar time dependence for omega of t. We're out of time. So tomorrow I'll finish off this and maybe another QFT example, and then we'll go back to figuring out how this works for inflation.